Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
I am sharing time with the Attorney General on these arguments. I intend in the first argument to reserve 2 minutes at least for the Attorney General, and then we're going to switch it up in the next case if we're doing both.
Okay, and you keep track of your time, you understand that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
May it please the Court.
May proceed.
Okay, I appeared before this Court about a year and a half ago in the case of Ward versus West County BMW. And part of the issue that we were exploring was the extent to which the Merchandising Practices Act would be interpreted broadly in order to protect consumers. And a year and a half later, I'm appearing before the Court with the expectation that we're going to be talking about the extent to which the Merchandising Practices Act will be interpreted broadly to protect consumers. And a thought occurred to me that it might not be a bad idea for me to ask the Court to perhaps reserve some time at the end of 2015, because I have a lot of these merchandising practices cases, and I expect I'm going to be back here.
Let me ask you this question then. I know you'll have the answers straight off the top of your head. How come is there a case, and I know you'll know the answer, as to why 16 CFR 433.2 does not apply to this kind of a case when you're talking about merchandising practices, unfair and deceptive practices, and basically the holder in due course?
You're talking about the holder in due course rule.
16 CFR 433.2, Federal Trade Commission.
I think it does. I did not think of pleading that as part of our
obligation. You don't have to. I'm just saying, why doesn't that apply?
I think it does. I think that
was a legend on there, the legend prescribed in 433.2 on any of these documents?
No.
Are they excluded? In the old days, and I know old days, the controller currency or the FTC or Federal Reserve came up with regulations, they all piggybacked on each other. So why would that, it deals with credit transactions?
Well, I know that the FTC requires the holder in due course rule to be stated in retail installment contracts. But I don't think that that's...
But also it talks about credit transactions as well. And you know, I have the whole legend here, it's in the rule. And the whole idea is if it didn't appear, then whoever the holder was would be violating the UDAP the statutes in their own states. It was a clever idea on the back of Michael Perchak and his folks that if it didn't appear, then the holder would be the liable for whatever the original seller was supposed to do.
Judge, I have to be honest, I did not consider that issue, but I think that that's a great argument.
Thank you.
I wanted to point out that Shelby Watson is here today. She actually came with her parents based on the importance of this case to her. And it occurred to me that when Shelby Watson leaves here and goes home tonight, she should be going to her condo on Washington Avenue in St. Louis. And I can say should with fair credibility, because after all, even though she did fall behind on a few months of payments on her mortgage, she reached a modification agreement with Wells Fargo. They agreed to modify her loan. And this wasn't simply a work in progress.
Is this an honest mistake that one part of this huge corporation, Wells Fargo, was doing one thing, loan modification, and another one was in charge of foreclosure, and one arm didn't know what the other was doing?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that one arm didn't know what the other was doing. As far as a huge mistake, you got one department that knew exactly what they intended to do was to take her house. And I don't think it mattered what any other department was doing within Wells Fargo. They knew that they were going to take her house.
Even the ones who were doing the motions to modify?
I don't know what their motivation is. I don't know really what overall role they played.
Was there federal law or federal money or something for the help with modifications or the ease it for the creditors to do more modifications, less foreclosures?
Well, certainly my understanding that these banks are getting all kinds of money from the federal government. And in some instances, if it's an FHA loan and there was an actual requirement that they had to abide by the regulations of the HUD secretary. This was not an FHA loan, so that didn't apply. To the extent that they were getting money from the government to modify these mortgages. I think, I don't have proof of that, and I haven't pled that or alleged it, but I think that's a motivating factor as to why they would modify this loan anyway. They didn't have to do it.
Well, it's a very complicated structure, and an individual attorney would find it extremely difficult to understand, as Senator Elizabeth Warren said, the complexity of these transactions.
Very complex.
If a corporation has knowledge, if its officers have gained knowledge about something through the course of their employment, then the corporation has that knowledge. It's not as if one individual employee has to have all the knowledge.
But, oh, sure.
So Wells Fargo knew they were renegotiating the loan and had done so and knew they were foreclosing.
Yeah,
tell us how that fits in with the MPA.
Well, I don't think that they're trying to use that as a defense. I don't think they're saying...
Right, absolutely. I'm just making sure when... So I wanted to hear your basic argument, which we haven't gotten let
why,
you get to.
Why is this in connection with the sale?
In connection with, okay. It's in connection with the sale because it's part of the sale. We have an opinion from the Eastern District that gives an extremely narrow interpretation to in connection with the sale, which I think is directly linked to its overall understanding of what a sale is. The Eastern District considers a sale to occur within a very narrow window of time. You come in, you negotiate a deal, you sign a contract, the ink's dry, the sale's over. Now, sale is defined in the Merchandising Practices Act, and it includes credit sales. But to consider a credit sale...
In the case of the professional debt case, that was a debt collector. Now, arguably, we didn't take transfer. But in that case, that was a debt collector who may not have necessarily purchased the paper. In this case, it's clear that Wells Fargo purchased the entire transaction. They purchased the paper, and with it would come the liabilities from whoever the previous owner was.
Yeah. There's these two phrases in the Merchandising Practices Act. There's in connection with, and there's after the sale. And the legislature put before, during, and after the sale as an amendment. I think it was in 1995. I'm not sure. But it was added after for some reason. There was some purpose, intention that they had. Getting back to in connection with, we have a period in which we're going to define the sale. And for a credit transaction, I think it only makes sense to consider the entire scope of the transaction as part of the sale. If you have a 30-year mortgage, you have a 30-year sale. I don't think the respondents have any argument with the fact that in the Shookman case, where they had lifetime warranty, the Merchandising Practices Act applied for a lifetime. Anything less than a lifetime should be perfectly acceptable.
You're saying the financing for the sale inherently is made in connection with the sale?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The entire transaction. So if any unlawful act occurs within that period, within the time of the sale, that occurs in connection with the sale.
So are you saying that a homeowner who subsequently secures additional financing on the purchase because they want to maybe get a home equity loan, that would still be in connection with the sale?
I would say a refinance would bring the first sale likely to an end, and then there would be a new sale that would begin with the new finance company.
How was her loan modification different than a refinancing?
It was the same company. It was part of the same transaction.
They modified the original.
It was a modification of the original deal. Now,
what happened when, obviously your client was distressed when she thought she did a loan modification and she was okay, and then 2 days later they foreclosed. When she contacted the company, what did they say?
There was an issue about whether she was satisfied with the terms of the modification that they offered. And the fact is that the actual modification that was offered wasn't really that great of a deal. And so she wasn't certain if this is even something that she wanted to accept. But she did accept it. That's unquestioning. She signed it. She sent it in by the deadline. They received it. They signed it. And part of now what Wells Fargo is saying is that Ms. Watson had made an indication that she wasn't happy with the terms and that, you know, that she rejected it. But There's no evidence.
When it foreclosed, did she contact Wells Fargo and say, what the heck's going on
well,
here?
Well, of course, yeah. No, she contacted Wells Fargo. She said, you guys have modified my loan. We had an agreement. I get to stay. And they're like, nope, sorry, we're foreclosing. And we filed a restraining order. And we filed a claim under the Merchandising Practices Act to try to get the home restored to her. And then what we had in the interim was these cases that were handed down by the Eastern District, the Portfolio Recovery and Professional Debt. And those cases held that the Merchandising Practices Act does not apply to unlawful debt collection. And then that was extended by the trial court to include unlawful foreclosures. Your Honors, I am sharing my time. I'm going to give my last 2 minutes to Brian Baer.
Yes,
you
have a little bit over 1 minute left.
I thank the court for indulgence in allowing us to present the testimony. The portfolio cases were wrong the day they were decided. They were wrong in the result, and they were wrong in the manner in which they achieved that result. And the implications.
And were we wrong? Are you implying that we were actually wrong? That's okay. You can do that.
There are many reasons why transfer may or may not have been granted.
It doesn't address the merits, does it?
No,
certainly.
It doesn't.
It's the case law could have, the court could have wanted the case law to develop, and this is the development before us today.
So tell us why they're wrong.
Primarily they're wrong because it is in contradiction of Gibbons. It's also in contradiction with Schutchman. The definition that was selected was an error as well. There were alternative definitions that, for instance, the Miller case that we cite from the Iowa Supreme Court, interpreting the phrase broadly. When a court is given many alternative different definitions.
You're talking about defining collection, and they looked at collection and or connection as opposed to in connection with.
Correct. And as a phrase, it does have a unique meaning attached to it that is broader. When the court has different definitions and constructions that can give to a phrase, and it's a remedial statute, the court should choose the one that gives the broadest effect. And the fact of the matter is that this is a endemic harm, a systematic harm that has been pled here that many consumers throughout the nation have suffered, was the subject of the second largest settlement in U.S. history with our office, premised on our authority to sue them under the MPA. And the Eastern District's decision effectively says that we had no authority to do so in the first place. So, the decision is wrong. We would ask for a full reversal or repudiation of portfolio and a new test to be articulated.
Well, just like the Attorney General of the United States or the FTC, should we give you more some credence because you're actually the Attorney General of the state of Missouri and you're enforcing these laws?
We would want it to be judged on the logical merits as anyone else. 407 does provide our ability to promulgate regulations, and we do a lot of 407 work. But I believe that our argument stands on its own merits. But we can speak with authority in saying that this is not just a problem or a consumer abuse or just Ms. Watson. We are talking about a systematic abuse that even has its own name.
And you can talk to the system because you're the Attorney General.
I'm sorry?
You can talk to the system because you're the Attorney General.
Yeah, certainly we try to do the best of our ability. I would say the National Mortgage Settlement is fairly well known and fairly well.
And there's been $100 billion in settlements from the different financial institutions in the United States on matters just similar to this one.
Exactly. I believe that we are at $50 billion with the original settlement, and I would say that Respondent was one of the first five servicers to settle in that national mortgage settlement. So somehow we obtained settlement relief for billions of dollars, despite the Eastern District positing that we had no authority to seek such. We would ask that the trial court be reversed and the matter remanded. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court.
May it proceed.
I'd like to bring us back around to looking at what the pleadings in this case are. It's a Missouri Merchandising Practices Act claim. As appellant admits in her reply brief, this is a quote, she never specifically pleaded the loan modification was a separate sale in her second amended petition. Now let's focus on that. There were two previous pleadings, the original petition chose to focus and specifically allege that the transaction at issue was the original sale transaction in 2006.
What was it they pled it was in connection with the original sale? Is that correct?
Correct.
With the sale?
That's right.
How is financing not part of in connection with a sale?
It is.
Okay.
We weren't involved in that.
So your view would be that privity of contract is required and a sale relieves you of all liability? You don't take and stand in the shoes of the assignor?
I do not take that position. I don't think privity is an issue here. And I think if Wells Fargo had been engaged in conduct that could arguably have been construed to violate an original term, a bargain for term of the original transaction. Again, Wells Fargo was not involved in that transaction. This was another lender. And I will say, Judge Teitelman, the record is devoid of any indication of whether or not Wells Fargo took an assignment of this deed of trust, whether they were just a servicer, what their role was.
But your position is that if the person with whom they'd originally negotiated the loan had not, like 90%+ of people involved in loans do, resold it to you, they could be sued for this, but you can't because it was resold to you, and that cuts the tie to the sale, despite the language, it's before, during, and after sale.
Under the facts of this case, Judge, the original lender could not be sued for this action any more than Wells Fargo could be sued for this action.
And I thought you said otherwise. That's why
I wanted to clarify. No, I'm sorry.
I'll
make that very clear.
Okay.
I don't think there's any question that if the original lender had done what Wells Fargo was alleged to have done, they would not be liable for a merchandising practice.
And why is that? Okay.
A couple of reasons. Paragraph 13 of the deed of trust specifically says that there is no obligation to modify the loan. And any agreement to accept the late payment, to do anything that in any way modifies the terms, is not an overall modification of that loan. So nobody had any obligation to modify the loan. And there is no other term in any of those loan documents that plaintiff alleges Wells Fargo violated.
Let's look. Even if there'd be no obligation if they undertake to negotiate modification, wouldn't they be bound by the terms?
You know, that's a good point. And my response to that
is that
is not the case. Because if we are going to read into every contract an automatic amendment based on a request by a borrower to modify their payment terms, and the lender says, well, yeah, I'll talk to you about that, if that's going to be deemed to be
a modification in any respect,
then...
But you signed... Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
You signed the modification, though, right?
That's not relevant to this record, Judge.
I think it is relevant. Of course, it may not be developed, and that can happen below, but you just said you can promise something, sign something, and not keep it, and that you have no obligation to keep it if it wasn't in the original term. Surely that's not your position. If you sign a contract, you're bound by it.
Let's assume
whether you were required to sign it or not.
Let's assume the contract was signed. All of the facts relating to signing that modification agreement were not developed because they were not relevant to the cause of action the plaintiff chose to plead, which is the original loan transaction, and whether or not any actions taken by Wells Fargo subsequent are in connection with that original loan transaction.
Well, I noticed in the brief you often add the phrase initial loan transaction, original loan transaction. Nothing in the statute says initial. It says in connection with the sale, before, during, or after. You're saying everything has to tie in with whatever you signed on the first day, but I don't, and I understand why you say that and your argument for it, but I don't see that language in the MPA. It says in connection with the sale, before, during, or after. If it had your language, if it said with the initial sale or with the day of the sale or the initial documents, you would have a very strong argument, but it doesn't say that. Doesn't that in itself weaken your position?
No. And the reason is because of other cases that have dealt with this issue. Suchman is one. I pronounce it Suchman. It's the case with the air conditioning warranty. That's a perfect example. If Wells Fargo had done something like the air conditioning vendor did in Suchman and repudiated a specific term of that agreement, that original transaction that was entered into with the purchaser of that unit, then certainly there could be liability. In the N. Ray Shelton case, bankruptcy case from the Western District, there were specifically incorporated terms of various regulations relating to how a lender was required to deal with a borrower. the bankruptcy court in In re Shelton, and that was a motion to dismiss, not a motion for summary judgment as here, found that because those guidelines were incorporated, the lender couldn't do something that was contrary to those terms. Now, let's look at this case. What Wells Fargo is alleged to have done is to talk to the appellant about a modification, and even if they agreed to that modification, there's nothing improper about talking to her about a modification. They're not even required to do a modification.
No, but assume for present purposes, because that's the allegation, they engaged in a modification and one was signed, so it's in effect. Mm-hmm. So we're not just talking about it.
Okay, then let me, the next step I wanted to take on that was that even if the modification is signed, it's not a new agreement that's subject to the MPA. It relates back to the original agreement.
It's part of your, how is financing or refinancing the terms of the sale not connected with the sale? When it occurs after, but the statute covers that. It occurs after the sale. It's in connection with the sale because it's renegotiating the terms of the sale. You weren't obligated to do it, but you did it, and you have a right to do it or not do it, but you can't act not in good faith, and you can't commit misrepresentations in the course of it. That's the allegation. Okay. I'm not at all suggesting that you did that, but why would that allegation, if proved, not be within the compass of the MPA?
Again, I have to go back. We have to be very particular and look at the pleadings. They allege we were involved in the original transaction, and we were not. And any actions that were taken afterwards, unless under the Suchman case and under the N. Ray Shelton case, unless we can point to a specific provision of that transaction that was violated by Wells Fargo, and we can't do that here, then there's no liability under the MPA. I think what may be troubling.
What transaction? Because the financing of the sale is ongoing. What I'm trying to get you to tell me, why are you saying we have to look back and see if they lied or changed or failed to agree with something that they agreed to on the first day? The question is in connection with the sale, and why aren't the finance terms always in connection with the sale? And so if at some later point there are misrepresentations as to them, that's in connection with the sale. It occurs after. It's an unusual situation. The common law, it might not apply, but we're dealing with the MPA, which is broad. What does that mean if not this kind of situation?
Well, I want to clarify one thing first, that this was not a refinancing. This was only a discussion about modification. The agreement that plaintiff has, or appellant has included in their legal file, says specifically that all the other terms and conditions will remain the same, and the only condition that was affected by this proposed modification was interest rate, and there is simply nothing improper that was done by Wells Fargo in relation to the terms. An example I would give you is, let's say Wells Fargo came to Ms. Watson and said, under the terms of the documents, we have a right to charge you now 2% per month late fee because you've been late so often. And we're going to do that, and if you don't agree to it, we're going to foreclose. That would be improper, because Wells Fargo wouldn't have any right under those original loan documents to do that. We don't have a similar situation here where you can point to some specific term of the agreement that's violated. And I think
isn't that a merits issue which may be successful for you, but it doesn't deal with our issue of does the MPA apply, not whether it's violated, where you're saying you have good arguments that it's not violated.
Well, it's a little broad to say, I think, does the MPA apply? I don't think there's any question that the MPA can apply to various transactions, but the pleadings plaintiff chose to pursue and did it three times was to say we were involved in the original financing transaction. They have never said that we were.
They said involved in the sale.
Pardon me?
Involved in the sale.
Right. We were not involved in the original sale.
But original, you keep adding original, and I'm saying it's not in the fact that you have to add it, doesn't that just emphasize that it's not in the MPA?
I think that's just a matter of going back and looking at what the phrase in connection with means.
Yes.
And that's why I keep looking at the Suchman and the N. Ray Shelton case as examples of that, because both of those cases find a specific term of the transaction that was originally entered into, and I'm sorry to keep using that word, but the transaction was originally entered into to determine whether or not there's liability for subsequent action. I think for this court to conclude that any action taken to discuss any type of modification or any modification of any other term without some specific reference to a particular term of the transaction as originally negotiated is going to create potentially unlimited liability because there's not going to be any standard against which to measure whether or not the subsequent actions are referable to the sale. And the only way to do that is to look at what the terms of the sale were. And again, I go back to Suchman and In re Shelton. Those are two perfectly good examples. I can't find any corollary to the type of action that was determined to impose liability in either Suchman or In re Shelton that exists in this case.
I want to make sure I understand. I'll go ahead and repeat your word. If the original lender was the party here instead of Wells Fargo, would they have liability under the MMPA?
Not for doing this.
And why?
Not for just talking to her about considering her request to modify the loan. Because there's nothing that they would have been doing that was contrary to the terms of the original loan transaction. And again, I have to go back to my penalty.
But if they'd gone ahead and improperly attempted to foreclose.
Pardon me?
If they had gone ahead and improperly attempted to foreclose, wouldn't they have liability?
No.
Why?
They have a right to do that under the loan documents. If the payment's not made, they have a right to do that.
But again, isn't that the merits? The question we're addressing is whether that conduct is made in connection with the sale as used in the MPA. If we find it is, then we go ahead to find out if, in fact, the allegations are true, that there were misrepresentations, there was a lack of good faith, and so forth. And I understand your argument that there was not, and that it was not improper, but that's different than the issue before us, which is that conduct in connection with the sale, and therefore subject to the MPA if they are able to prove their allegations, which I understand you completely deny.
Well, I think that goes to the in connection with again, and that's
yes.
What I keep going back to the Suchman and In re Shelton cases. We need some objectively identifiable criteria in terms of some provision of the agreement between the parties that is violated by the contact. Otherwise, you don't have any new sale or advertisement that is subject to the Act.
Well, you have the original sale, and the financing terms are part of the sale. You're paying for it still. That's certainly, the payments are made in connection with the sale. They're the reason for the sale, and the sale's not complete until you've finished paying for it. I mean, you're taking it back under the terms of it because they're still paying on that original sale. How are those payments not being made in connection with the sale? And if you committed misrepresentations as to the need to make payments, the nature of the payments, refinancing the payments, or what is adequate to trigger foreclosure, why isn't that an allegation that, if proved, is in connection with the sale?
They didn't say we engaged in any misrepresentation in connection with the discussions on the loan modification. They're saying we didn't honor it. That might be a breach of contract claim. And interestingly, they did try to assert a breach of contract claim on the eve of granting the motion for summary judgment. A suit for specific performance was proposed. The trial court rejected that. Now, for whatever reason, plaintiff chose not to preserve that for appeal and chose not to bring it to this court. I think there might be a breach of contract case here, but there's not an MPA claim unless, again, you can take the conduct and tack it back to something in the agreement that was negotiated by the party, the sale or advertisement that was the original transaction.
Thank you.
Now, you know, we might have a, like, if, for example, if somebody used the example of if you refinanced it. If Ms. Watson had come to Wells Fargo and said, I want to do a total refinance, I don't want to do anything with that other loan, and something was done improper in that, that's an MPA claim, that's fine. But under these facts, under what plaintiff chose to allege three times, that it's the original 2006 transaction, what was done later based on Suchman and In re Shelton is simply not in connection with, nor does it have a relationship in fact with the original financing.
So your position is that refinancing could be in connection with the sale?
A total refinancing that is a new contract and is not just a modification of the existing terms, certainly.
A new promissory note, a new deed of trust.
But you're not saying it's in connection with the first sale. You're
no,
saying
it's
it creates its own separate cause of action.
That's right. It's a totally new deal.
It's a new sale.
And so, and that's not what we have here.
Right, I understand.
We have a modification. It's not a total refinancing. But unless there are other questions, that's all I have. I would ask that you maybe reconsider your decision to grant transfer and just remand it. But thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
Now, I noticed, I think you quoted Professor Michael Greenfield, who wrote the definitive text in consumer law in regard to the sale of this contract. I assume he did a survey of all the states and came up with his...
Well, that's my old contracts professor. And he was actually cited by Amicus NCLC. But he is one of the renowned authorities throughout the country on consumer law issues, absolutely.
And the MPNA is a remedial statute. Is it not? How far can you take that?
You take it as far as it goes. I mean, it's going to depend on the facts. And the respondents, understandably, they're doing their job, but they're trying to paint this as some runaway application of the statute that it has no grounding. But what are the facts of the particular case? We really can't make a determination whether we're stretching the MPA too far without knowing what the actual facts are. And like going back to the Schuchman case, they would seem to agree that the Merchandising Practices Act would apply for a lifetime. If you have a lifetime warranty, that's particular to those facts. It's not always going to be a lifetime. We need to point out that this modification wasn't just over a couple of weeks. This was something that was negotiated over a long period of time. And Wells Fargo actually made the promise that, we're not going to foreclose as long as we're in the process of negotiating this modification. But if Wells Fargo had simply said...
Well, they finished the negotiation, you signed the agreement, so they weren't in the process of negotiating anymore. They just decided to foreclose 2 days later.
Well, we agree.
Counsel, what is the sale that is alleged in the petition?
The sale is the extension and servicing of the loan agreement.
So the 10 or 15 or 30 times that he said that the allegation in the petition is the 2006 loan, he was wrong.
No, that's part of the sale. But the problem is they're looking at a static event. They're saying these documents were signed in 2006, therefore we have a sale that occurred in 2006.
Now that's a question about whether it's in connection. I'll get to that. I'm asking what sale it is that you allege triggered the MMPA.
The sale that I am particularly relying on is the extension of the mortgage loan in 2006.
Okay.
And my argument is that the servicing of that loan is not just in connection with the sale, but as part of the sale. That the sale itself encompasses a length of time beyond simply the ink drying on paper. The example that I would give would be the portfolio case. You have an extension of a credit card, and you have the servicing of that credit card debt, and we don't know how long that's going to be for, but for whatever that period of time is, that would encompass the sale, that entire period of time. Let's say it's 3 years, 5 years, but at some point that sale came to an end. It came to an end when you had a default and a charge-off. But even still, the Merchandising Practices Act applied to the or should have applied, the Eastern District disagrees, to the then assignee, because now the after-the-sale language applies from the Merchandising Practices Act. So it picks up everything.
Maybe this question is not for you, but for your co-counsel. Is the implication of dual tracking, which is prohibited by the national mortgage settlement, implicated here at all under the MPA?
Well, that's exactly what they did. It's dual tracking. It's two branches. Left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And as Mr. Baer, I think, articulately argued, they subjected themselves to the settlement on.
Is this case not within it? It was too late, too early? Or have they violated the settlement? We'll be addressing that, I think, in the next case. That's all right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Matter will be taken under submission. Thank you.